Welcome back, everyone, to Keeping Current, the podcast from ERS and HVM designed to plug you into the world of electrical power systems. I'm your host, Joe O'Dwyer, and in this episode, we're breaking down OSHA's latest regulatory changes and what they mean for electrical professionals. From properly fitting PPE requirements to multilingual hazard communication, as well as increased enforcement, we'll cover the updates that directly impact field operations, compliance strategies, and day-to-day safety practices. Joining me today is Steve Park, Director of Training and Employee Development at ERS. With more than 45 years' experience in the power system industry, Steve is a recognized expert in electrical safety, compliance, and professional development, and his insights will help you not just understand the new rules, but implement them effectively. So get ready to unplug and connect, and welcome back to Keeping Current, Steve.
Well, thanks for having me, Joe.
My pleasure. Steve, as you're aware, these OSHA updates touch on several areas, but one of the biggest shifts is in personnel protective equipment, also PPE, is something every electrical professional uses daily. We both have used it early in our careers. Yet the new standards bring a fresh perspective on how it's defined and applied. OSHA's new PPE requirements sound straightforward, but can I ask, why is this such a significant change for electrical safety in the field?
Well, I don't think it's so much a significant change as a clarification of the original intent. The new language states that PPE must properly fit each affected employee. This replaces language using a more general terminology, such as must provide and use appropriate PPE. So the older language could be misinterpreted as simply meaning using the correct glove class or the correct arc rating of clothing, and not really about the fit and wear requirements of the PPE.
That is bringing back a lot of memories of wearing PPE that didn't fit me in the past. What kind of issues have you seen by poorly fitting PPE, particularly in the high voltage world?
Yeah, so I got my career started way back as a lineman. As a lineman, we often did a lot of line work, and we regularly used insulated tools and rubber gloves, etc. And, you know, I've got smaller hands, I'm a smaller person, and I had difficulty wearing the rubber gloves that were issued to me that were out of the stock supply of gloves, and I didn't have the dexterity I needed to work safely. As a matter of fact, if I put my hands to my side, the gloves would probably just drop off my hands. And so after complaining about the fitting of my gloves and the problems that they were causing, they did manage to order some properly fitting gloves, which resolved my issue. Now, I've also seen employees attend our new hire safety training course, and their work clothing, which is arc rated, doesn't always fit very well. They're either excessively baggy or they might even be excessively snug. And both of these issues can affect the performance of the arc rating and unnecessarily allow an injury to occur. If arc rated PPE is too tight, it may permit the transfer of heat through the material to the skin or undergarment. And of course, if it's too loose, it's gaping it open and heat can get underneath the garment. I always like to say your PPE needs to meet the Goldilocks standard. It needs to fit just right.
That is an excellent analogy, From an employer's perspective, what steps do you think we should be taking now to ensure compliance with this requirement from an employer's perspective?
Well, I think the best example I can come up with is how not to manage PPE. Often, in an effort to save money, they use common PPE equipment or maintain a stock of equipment. Workers will then sign out whenever they need it. And this is wrong on so many levels. PPE is personal protective equipment. You should be responsible for the wear and care of your PPE, especially when you're talking about rubber gloves and arc-rated PPE clothing. These items are very personal. Also, if you have PPE available to you when you think you might need it, what happens in an emergency when you weren't planning to need it? Let's say you're working on equipment that's supposed to be de-energized, but something goes wrong. Someone gets into something energized. Are you going to run down to the tool room, sign out some rubber gloves so you can come back and pull your coworker off the equipment? That doesn't make sense.
Correct.
And that's the scenario I review with my students during safety training. You should always be thinking about what if. Even though your assigned work may not require rubber gloves, if you at least have them in the vicinity where you're working, should something go wrong, you can quickly get to them, reduce the injuries to your coworker, and not place yourself in harm's way. Another aspect of this requirement is that now that we have a much more diverse workforce, I've seen firsthand in our new hire training safety classes an uptick in women being hired as field engineers. And I think this is great. In over my nearly 50 years in the workforce, I've seen a small percentage of women in the electrical trade. However, recently, there's an increase in women joining this exciting career field. And of course, the new PPE needs to be able to fit everybody, all individuals.
That's a great point. I can honestly say that I've only seen a handful of women in the field, and it just brings a little bit of class and professionalism to the group, as well as everybody making sure that they're working safely. So I have to agree. But my next question is, how does this impact PPE procurement, inventory, and the training programs and requirements that are need to be provided?
Yeah, so with these new requirements that clearly state that the PPE must be properly fitted, and as the workforce becomes more diverse, it'll drive PPE manufacturers to revisit their designs and their options for PPE. And employers will need to make sure that they have properly fitted PPE readily available to those workers. Since the mid-1990s, when we first became introduced to this newly quantified electrical hazard called arc flash, we've seen the evolution of many products to help us work safer. From improved arc-rated PPE to relays and trip units that allow delayed opening and closing, and portable remote operating devices that allow the workers to get away from the equipment when it operates. We've also seen a major revision of IEEE 1584, which provides the arc flash modeling methods and equations we use to estimate incident energy levels. As this technology is developed, it evolves, it matures, we must constantly evaluate what is the best way to keep our workers safe. In our safety training for newly hired field employees, we stress the need to ensure they get the right PPE clothing, tools, and equipment. Ensure that the PPE fits them, that they recognize signs that indicate the PPE needs to be replaced. For our daily PPE wear, the employee needs to be aware of the care of the garment, and not so much how many times they wash them, but how they wash them, what to use and what not to use. They need to recognize signs that the material is worn or if they've been ripped or damaged. When those issues are noted, the employee needs to get their clothing replaced. These are very important topics to cover so the employees know and understand their responsibilities related to their PPE. Now, our company is very specific when it comes to PPE. From our daily workwear, to arc-rated suits for higher levels of incident energy levels, to PPE that might be required in special circumstances. We have a comprehensive catalog that our employees can access and ensure they know what equipment is available to them and get the right equipment for their assigned tasks and their skill levels. I will say that one of the biggest challenges we have is the sizing of the PPE daily work garments. The manufacturer's sizes don't always align with the fit of standard clothing. New employees are constantly sending back garments because of a poor fit. Whenever possible, it's best if you can find a pair of pants and a shirt and do a trial fit before placing that order.
I'm going to have to agree with you on that as far as the fit and as we get older. I, too, went from being a world-class athlete to, just a normal person. So I understand. My next question, though, is what are the most important changes in the new hazard comm standard for the electrical and power system professionals?
So the most important thing about HAZCOM is the comm part, the communication.
Right.
Our employees need to know that there is a change. So when they see changes to the safety data sheet information, they know why it is different and understand the differences. A lot of these types of changes often go without workers being aware that there was a change and how it affects them. Then they come across the new label designation and they don't know what to do or how to manage the hazard. Make sure you include the employees in the training and communication about the changes so they're not caught off guard and unaware.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you on that. I think the biggest attribute that ERS and HVM has is that phenomenal safety culture we take for granted as compared to others. So I have to agree with you on that.
Absolutely.
One thing, and this I've come across as well, how do you see multilingual hazard communication impacting safety on the job site with diverse crews, multiple languages, multiple cultures? So how do we cross that bridge, if you would?
Yeah, this is a real challenge. I've seen firsthand the challenges of multilingual issues on job sites. We've delivered some product-specific training at many data centers, the construction sites, over the past year or so. And a large percentage of the workers actually doing the work don't speak English. I don't even know how well they understand English. They sit through the training. They nod their heads as if they understand. But then we continue to have the same installation issues related to things that we specifically cover in the training. And that gets frustrating. And you know, I don't really blame the worker. I blame management. They know, or at least should know, the capabilities and limitations of their workers with respect to language barriers. And we specifically tell the employers that they are the ones responsible for any translation. And I use Hispanic as an example because that's what I've seen the biggest problem with. And the same challenge will involve any hazard communication, whether it be chemicals or on the job site, installation, electrical, mechanical. You know, these individuals that may have a language barrier issue, you know, they don't read warning signs, they don't understand hazard labels. This can result in an accident. So it's very near and dear to my heart to make sure that everybody pitches in and contributes to breaking down this multi-language barrier.
I could not agree more. I mean, the way I view it, sometimes when I'm speaking English to English-speaking counterparts, even we have problems with communication. So when we have the different languages, it just adds to that. So I couldn't agree more. One thing I wanted to ask is, what should companies be doing now to update labels, SDSs, and training to meet these new requirements as they're constantly changing?
Yeah, so we definitely need to ensure that you have the latest updated labels and safety data sheets, make sure they're available and in our employees' hands. Now, we primarily use an online service for our safety data sheets, so I assume that those will be updated in a timely manner by the service provider. I think the most important thing companies need to do is provide awareness training for those changes. Employees need to have an overall understanding of the changes and how those changes impact our work sites and what we do and how it impacts the chemicals we use. Now, our company does a great job at controlling the use of chemicals. We have an approved list of chemicals that, and only those chemicals can be used by our employees. They can go, you know, they can't go down to Home Depot or Walmart and get a cleaner that they like or they think they need. If they believe there's a product that does a better job than the ones on our approved list, well, they can submit that request and the alternative product will be evaluated. The submitted products, they need to meet several key criteria to be accepted. And if they are accepted into our inventory, it most likely will replace another chemical as opposed to just being added to the list. That way we limit our chemical inventory and exposure to various chemicals.
Oh, that's a good process. I never thought of that. That's a great idea to limit that. How does HAZCOM compliance tie into overall electrical safety and NFPA standards?
Well, I think HAZCOM compliance ties into the overall safety culture established within our company. Whether it be general safety, chemical safety, or electrical safety, it's one component of the overall safety culture and a key component of the protection of our employees. Now, I've been guilty, especially in my younger and dumber years, of using chemicals without regard to their potential hazard. I built and flew radio-controlled airplanes in my younger days, and I'd sit in my basement for hours using super glue and epoxy and chemicals to put these model planes together without giving second thought to all the fumes I was exposing myself to. By providing our employees with effective training, we can help them be aware of the hazards and the actions that they should take to protect themselves from the effects of using chemicals.
Proper ventilation for that application, sure. Steve, you've seen compliance enforcement evolve over the decades, but let me ask you, how significant is this penalty increase that we have to deal with now?
Yeah, well, wouldn't it be great if we didn't need financial threats to ensure adherence to safe work practices? What a world that would be. With respect to increased penalties for willful and repeat violations, I wish they were bigger. And one reason for the increase in fines and penalties is simple economics. With recent inflation and decreased value in the dollar, it's only natural that penalties over time are going to increase.
Right.
And while no one wants to see a worker get injured, for various reasons, it happens. It may be the result of a poor work culture, time pressures to get the job done, lack of training or ineffective training, improper tools and equipment, an employee's lack of knowledge and understanding, and sometimes the employee intentionally cuts corners and makes mistakes. Now, I honestly believe that in at least cases where employers have a poor safety call, they've clearly not provided effective training, and they place workers in dangerous situations, and a worker is injured or killed, the penalties should be huge. Right. If there's irrefutable evidence that the employer is negligent, the penalties should be huge. On the other extreme, if the company has proven to have a good safety culture, provides effective training, has documented the employee demonstrating the required safety skills as required by NFPA 70E, but the evidence shows that the employee intentionally did not adhere to accepted and established practices, I'd like to see OSHA lessen the level of violation and penalty to the company. Now, I'm not saying the employee ought to be held accountable or be fined or anything like that. But where the company has met all of their requirements, but the employee still knowingly and willfully violated the safe work rules, I do believe there's, you know, things that should be done to lessen the penalty to the company and somehow hold the employee somewhat accountable. And I do believe from every incident, close call, near miss, there's always lessons to be learned when an accident happens. Even if you think you're doing everything right, you still need to objectively examine the incident and find ways to make your program better. Now, when I present safety topics in training sessions, I often present case studies of incidents so others can learn from real life events. And I believe that really helps make the training experience more effective.
I could not agree more with your position on that. I think if the companies do everything in their power to meet the due diligence of safety and PPE and policies and procedures, and somebody just doesn't utilize it or implement it that day, but the company has it there and it's documented everything, I think a large amount of understanding should be afforded in that. So I could not agree more. Real quick, where do you think electrical service providers and facility managers are most at risk for citations under these changes?
Yeah, I think the primary impact will be for those companies that don't have a good safety culture, that don't provide effective safety training. Those that have little regard for the safety of their employees, those companies that are focused on the bottom line and not the long term, can easily be repeat offenders. And those are the ones that are going to be hit with the huge fines and penalties. I'll never forget back when ArcFly safety and awareness first came about in the late 90s or early 2000s. We were working at a large automotive facility and assisting a customer with switching for an outage. And we had a 15 kV switch that was not operating properly. And the customer that I'd worked with for many years and I had a really good relationship with did something completely against the current safe work practices. His actions caught me complete off guard, and he did something that I felt was extremely dangerous. And he did it so quickly, I couldn't say or do anything before he did it. After the fact, we had some words. We exchanged some words. And his reply was, well, that's the way I've always done it, and it's never been an issue before. And I'll never forget that day, as it really shook me to the core. And I realized that his view of working safe and my view were completely different. And over the years, I've noticed that, especially those without good effective training, everyone doesn't view safety the same way. What one person considers safe may not be considered safe by another. And when I deliver safety training, I try to level the playing field so that everyone is in agreement on what is safe.
I could not agree more with that last statement. And in fact, that's one of my, when I teach to my students, that's on one of my slides. Everybody must be on the same page. Like, excellent perspective. My next question is, how can proactive safety programs protect both workers and the company bottom line?
Well, that's the $10,000 question, isn't it?
Right.
yeah. You know, when I think about that, the book Winning Now, Winning Later, I'll give it a cheap plug here, by Vertiv's chairman of the board, Dave Cote, comes to mind. Proactive safety programs definitely fall into that winning now, winning later strategy. You know, so many times we hear mantras like winning now, winning later, safety first, or some other business slogan. And then we see that they're not really applied in the day-to-day operational decisions. They become background noise. They become white noise. They fade into the background, and you don't even think about them anymore. So many times we focus on winning today at all costs and without regard for next year, next quarter, next month, or even next week. Establishing a proactive and effective safety program not only gives your workers knowledge and skills to make good decisions about safety, but indirectly, they're protecting or even improving the bottom line in the long run. If you do the right things today related to safety, all other things automatically will fall into place. A little extra spend on training, getting the right PPE, getting the right tools, can result in huge windfalls down the road. Preventing a single major reportable incident can pay for the investment in safety many times over. Safety is the best hedge fund a business can have.
I've seen both the proper implementation and a negative implementation, and you can very easily see the results. So very good. What should electrical professionals be doing now to prepare for a heat illness prevention standard?
Now that we're through most of the summer?
Right.
Well, I'm not sure what the final language will be in OSHA regarding heat injury and illness, but I'm assuming it'll codify or make law what the reasonable person already does to protect workers from issues related to extreme heat. By making this language very specific related to heat injuries, OSHA is creating a means of penalizing and fining companies for ignoring reasonable protection of employees related to heat injuries. Those in the electrical industry are often required to work in adverse conditions such as hot and cold environments. I'm probably starting to sound like a broken record here, but I think communication is the best way to ensure everyone is informed of these new requirements. Now, I don't think our company really has much to do with respect to this issue because I think we're already focused on our employees' safety.
Right.
I know at the beginning of each summer, our company will always communicate information about heat illness, how to identify it, what to do about it. Our frontline supervisors, they must stay connected to their teams and be ready to step in and ensure our workers are protected in these situations.
I have to agree. Being in the military, stationed overseas in a tropical climate, working outside for many, many years, I've dealt with the heat, but not only but the heat and heat stroke and stuff, but we also have to be aware of sunburn. That can have a negative impact as well as we get older and such. So we always need to not only be hydrated, but sunscreen as well. Sunscreen is absolutely one of the best things we can do. So,
yep.
From your perspective, what are the best practices for heat stress monitoring in the electrical field work?
Well, I think during the, each job, you should have a tailgate safety meeting. And it's at that point where I think the job lead should openly address, the heat issue. Make it known. Hey, guys, it's going to be a hot one out there today.
Yeah.
Make everyone aware that they're expected to take breaks and make sure they're consuming liquids regularly. Studies show that it's much more effective to consume liquids regularly than to consume large amounts periodically. I've also seen crews put up shade coverings like party tents or canopies. Keeping the direct sunlight from directly shining on you goes a long way during hot days. The job leader supervisor will need to be mindful of their team and monitor them. And everyone's different. Everyone handles heat differently. While I'd like to think that an employee will take a break and drink their fluids, they may not be aware of the effect the heat's having on them until it's too late. And by letting the employees know that it's okay to take extra breaks due to the heat and have the supervisor suggest the employees take a break, maybe we can avoid some of the serious injuries. And specific to electrical workers, in addition to working out in the heat and in the sun, electrical workers are often required to perform work while wearing arc-rated clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And this clothing, especially the higher-rated suits like the 40 cal flash suits, can be very hot even when the weather's not hot. If you use the ventilation fans for the suits, they're still uncomfortable. So when a worker's placed in these conditions, it's easy for them not only to become heat-stressed, but to start making bad decisions. They're hot. They can't see because their face shield's fogged up. They're tired. Their brain is focused on the heat and not the task at hand. All they want to do is get out of that suit. These factors can become key contributing factors to a serious incident. Now, also, you may have workers that don't want to disappoint anyone. They'll keep enduring the hot work conditions, not only so they aren't seen as being weak, but they may feel that stopping because they're exhausted may risk their employment. We employ a lot of former military service members like you and me. And in the military, you go until you can't go anymore. And under some circumstances, especially in the military, that's normal and expected. In the electrical field, in the civilian world, that can create a dangerous and unacceptable situation. So job leads and supervisors and managers all need to step up and be leaders. They need to stay connected with the crew and be aware and be observant. Instead of pushing an employee until they collapse, recognize the situation, ask them to stop before they start exhibiting signs of heat stress or heat stroke. Suggest they take a break. Get them some fluids. Find them a cool place to sit and cool down. These are all proactive actions and the actions of a good leader.
I could not agree with you more regarding the heat. my years of experience was working in the Nevada desert at a power plant. So we did everything we could to ensure there was plenty of water available, Gatorade available. We didn't want to drink the sodas and the sweet juices. We wanted something that would help with, you know, the electrolyte and keeping us going. So,
yeah, exchange the energy drinks for some water.
Exactly. No Red Bulls.
Yes.
If you could recommend one change a facility or service provider should implement this quarter, what do you think it would be?
Well, I'd like to see more of our leaders reinforce the company safety culture. Make employees aware that they are never expected to violate any safe work practice. And if they observe a potentially unsafe situation, that they utilize their stop work authority and also complete a near miss report. I make sure that I emphasize this when I provide new hire training classes, and I'd like to see that echoed by the supervisors and the managers periodically to reinforce this key message.
And I agree with you. I think that should be reinforced. How can electrical teams use these new OSHA rules as an opportunity to strengthen their overall safety programs?
I think supervisors and managers can use these changes not only to communicate the new rules, but to address other similar requirements to help reinforce the overall safe work practices. It's also a good opportunity to hear from the workers. These safety discussions should not be a lecture, but a two-way discussion and a conversation. If you're a supervisor or a manager, make sure you give your team an opportunity to ask questions, invite questions, relay information, provide feedback about things that are happening that may not be aligned with the company's safety culture. Nobody wants to work in an environment that's not safe. Everyone wants to go home at night and not end up being injured or in a hospital or worse. Use this opportunity to communicate these expectations to all of your employees.
Thank you for that one. But one of my last questions coming up, any advice for leaders trying to balance compliance requirements with the real world operational demands? We have both faced those.
Absolutely. And that's always the challenge. And I go back to my winning now, winning later comment. While you have to keep your eye on what's happening today, you should always be thinking about tomorrow. Is the short-term pain worth the long-term gain? I often have conversations with managers when I schedule new employees for the required safety training. And they ask to delay it because they've got this big job and they need the new employee assigned to the job. And I'd explain, you know, to the manager the risk associated with having an employee on a large job that doesn't have the minimal safety training requirements. Their focus is on today and not tomorrow. And I get that. I was in operations for many years. One of the key factors to managers pushing back on the training was that because we had a huge hiring initiative this year and last year, we fell behind in providing the new hire safety training in a timely period. Some of the new employees would be working for us for several months before they'd get to attend the class. And that was not the employee's fault, and it wasn't the manager's fault. That was my fault. So I understood the need to have the employee productive since they've been with us for such a long time. So over the past several months, we've hired more instructors and conducted more classes with larger headcounts, more students to catch up on that backlog of new employees. Now, as soon as I receive a notification of an employee being hired, sometimes even before their very first day on the job, they're already scheduled for an upcoming class to attend, and it's usually done within the first 30 days of employment. And I think that's a win-win solution. Uh-huh. I also must acknowledge that I've had exceptional support from our upper management to make this training happen and get these newly hired employees through our safety training as early as possible once they're hired. And one of the statements we make in our new hire safety class is that safety is not a priority. And that statement usually gets the student's attention. What do you mean it's not a priority? Well, depending on the day, depending on the job, priorities change.
Uh-huh.
So we say safety is a core value. Everything we do with safety in mind. We're committed to providing the tools, the training, and the equipment to enable our employees to work safely and to be successful.
I think that core value issue that you just brought up makes me pause because I'm always using safety as a priority. I think what I need to do is change my message.
Absolutely.
Well, Steve, thank you for joining us today. I know you're busy and for sharing your expertise on OSHA's latest regulatory changes. I just want to ask, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to share before we break?
Well, thanks for having me. And yeah, just the employer needs to make sure that they stay in touch with the various industry changes and communicate those changes to the employees. And that the employee, they're responsible too. They must pay attention to the changes and to the training that are communicated and understand how those changes affect what you do. Ask questions if you don't understand. If you don't understand the significance of the changes, ask questions. Make it a communication. These meetings and updates of information should not be a lecture. They should be a conversation.
Well, I want to thank Steve for his time, but that's it for this episode of Keeping Current. If you found today's conversation valuable, please be sure to subscribe. Let us know how we're doing. Please leave us a review. And tune in every other Thursday for more expert insights. Connect with us on LinkedIn to stay in the loop. And as always, thanks for listening. Until next time, keep current.